Hello and welcome to another episode of Django Chat, a weekly podcast on the Django Web Framework. I'm Will Vincent, joined by Carlton Gibson. Hi, Carlton.
Hello, Will.
And this week we are joined by David Sanders. Hi, David.
Hey. Hey, guys. Thanks for having me.
Hello, David. Thanks for coming on.
So you maintain the current JWT package, which is almost mandatory for use with Django REST Framework. So we want to ask you about that and all your other work. But first, what's your backstory? How'd you get into programming and specifically Python Django?
Let's see. Yeah, I was trying to think about how I would come about this question as I was showering in the morning. Let's see, I think I probably got into programming for similar reasons to a lot of other sort of nerdy kids growing up in the 90s. And, you know, I was like, I liked video games and things like that. And but yeah, it also just so happened that I went to a high school which had some classes for that, which I think was not super common in the 90s.
I grew up in the 90s and there was zero programming classes,
yeah,
even in a college town.
Right. I mean, so it was pretty early on. And so, you know, this is when computers were just starting to become sort of household fixtures and the internet was...
We had email. We had email. I remember in my high school, we were very proud of that, like,
yeah,
in the
right.
late 90s. But
yeah.
It sort of stopped at email.
No, yeah, exactly. Programming, I mean, classes. That gives you an idea. That's like a good litmus test for what we're talking about here. Because email had just showed up in its, you know, to the average person in its probably most early form. And yeah, I remember my middle school actually had email, or like it allowed you to sign up for a Unix account. And this was in like 93 or something. And that was in Boulder, by the way, where I'm living now.
Yeah. Well, there's probably some similarities because I'm from basically Dartmouth. And so Dartmouth had its own homegrown email system way back in the day.
Yeah.
And
I think I remember
the high
that
school
either.
System. Yeah. And they, you know, created the term AI at some conference in the 50s. But the high school's email system was based on Dartmouth, which was called Blitz, I believe. So I think you could, you know, you could AOL, you could, like, you know, CDs were flying around, you could connect that way. But to have, you know, high school run email system in the mid 90s was unusual, but probably not atypical for high schools in, you know, university towns where you had
that was,
some degree
that was
of knowledge.
It. That was it. Because I remember Boulder Valley School District had this Unix server, which, you know, at the time I was just like, oh, okay, so we have that. But I guess later I found out that the server was actually at CU, or University of Colorado at Boulder. So it was actually located there. And I assume it was part of, you know, the technology departments or the engineering school or something. So yeah, so that was lucky. And I think that was a big reason why there were programming classes and why I was able to, you know, pursue that interest early on.
That's interesting as well that you had Unix available, because when I was, you know, I was in the 90s, it was, for me, it was all Windows, and, you know, that was great and it was all fun, but I didn't discover Unix till I got to university 97. I was like, what's this? How do I, you know, how do I do anything here?
Yeah, right. And I started on a Macintosh machine, and this was like way before Macs were like even really a thing. I mean, they were, but they were definitely kind of less common.
Well, I did too, if I think back, because like in the 80s, Mac or Apple made a big push to get in school systems. So the old, Mac 2s, that was what we had.
Actually, that's true. I remember that, yeah.
So they were like, you know, they were in all the schools, and then they went away, and then they came back as being super high priced. But for a while it was, I mean, because I remember my middle school, we had a computer class where you learned how to type, and someone told me if you just took the test in the beginning, that was an option. So I did that. So I remember just playing Oregon Trail and like Manhole for a semester, which was pretty fun.
Yeah, yeah, that's a good point, because I do remember that I always saw Macs in schools, and, you know, and we didn't have an Apple IIe, we had a Macintosh. So we actually had a color monitor, which was like 13 inches or something.
Well, I always remembering sort of that time, because I just the game Myst, I played
Myst
around then,
and
it was middle school for me, so 93 94.
Yeah, that was middle school for me too.
Yeah. Sorry, Carlton.
No, I'm loving it. I'm just thinking, old man, well, talk about computing.
Yeah.
No, but I was going to say that
the early days of technology is really fond memories. Yeah.
Well, that game is so good. And then you can get it on the iPad now. And since I've been quarantined with a bunch of kids, and I've totally forgot the game. So I downloaded it and I've been playing it. It's still so good. And then my 7-year-old daughter, I was feeling kind of good that I remembered a couple things, but it's, yeah, think about it. She's just like touching stuff. She zipped through like more than I did. She was like 3 times as good as I am.
Yeah.
So it's sort of humbling.
Myst
anyways,
is such
yeah,
an
back
interesting
in the day.
Road marker, because I remember at the time it came out, it just blew my mind how amazing it looked. And of course it was all just pre-rendered videos essentially. And it was, it was basically written in PowerPoint, you know, that it was this thing called a HyperCard. And so, you know, if PowerPoint had a scripting language, which maybe it does, but I don't think that's really a selling point of it. That's how you could orient yourself in this conversation. Like, this video game was like very popular and was written in PowerPoint essentially, and just embedded videos in PowerPoint slides.
Well, the update is pretty fun on the iPad because they've redone it, so you can. It's not, you can sort of move around a little bit, make it 3D, and the graphics are slightly improved. But sorry, last thing on this, because I've been, so there's another game, Riven, which came after in high school, 97, 98. Yeah. And I haven't gotten that yet on the iPad, but I'm going to. But I remember playing that. There's like 4 discs on it, and you have to go between worlds. And so every time I had to move, I had to like swap discs. And besides the fact it was like way harder and I had to cheat to finish it, I remember just endlessly swapping discs, which was super frustrating. So I'm excited to not have to do that on the iPad coming up soon.
Yeah.
Anyways, total tangent. Sorry.
That's great though. I mean, this is in a way kind of the story of how I got into programming. Like, I just loved things like this when I was a kid, and probably a little bit before a lot of other people took interest in these kind of things. And then I was lucky enough to have access to educational resources, and so it just kind of went from there. And in school, I sort of did engineering. I kind of didn't. I was kind of half did it. But then,
this
of course,
is college or
in university and college. And but then eventually, of course, I ended up doing it for a living either way. So,
when did Python factor in? Right? When did you just get into the Python world?
Yeah, so let's see. So I basically ended up getting a music degree. That's my formal education. So that's kind of an interesting tidbit about me, which is something I choose. Now I've decided to broadcast that to the world, it seems. So it's not something I...
Well, musicians make some of the best programmers. I mean, where I am in Boston, there's Berklee School of Music, and a lot of the best programmers in Boston are former Berklee musicians who, you know, it's hard to make a living, but they are very used to dedicated practice.
Yeah, right.
And so that translates extraordinarily well to programming. Actually.
Yeah, maybe there's a sort of kind of abstract ability to go deep on things somehow that becomes useful. Anyway, so let's see. Where was I going with this? I feel like we're going.
So you studied music in school.
Yeah. Oh, right. And so then I was coming out of that degree. I just decided to, just get back into technology for obvious reasons, because it's hard to make it as a musician. And so some of the first jobs I was finding at the time were like PHP sort of web app type stuff. And that was how I kind of reintroduced myself into the tech world. And I had had even a few sort of software jobs before finishing school, but that was sort of a different era of software. And so, as I sort of got back into the tech world, I think that was like 2008 or 9. It was like right about when smartphones had happened and, social media was starting to kick off a second sort of dot-com boom, essentially. And so there were lots of kind of web app type, there was a lot of web app work available. So getting into PHP, and that transitioned into my next job doing Python and Django. And it was all in the vein of like web application work. And Yeah, so that was when I joined a company called FusionBox in Denver, which I believe is still around. And they were a Python shop, and they had a number of really talented Python developers doing Django development. And that was where I got into it. And I think that was about 2011 or so.
That's still relatively, I mean, early-ish for Django. I know, what would you say, Carlton? I mean, I know Django had been out for a while, but it wasn't
That's the
popular
sort
as
of
much.
similar time that I found it, and it was similar sort of reasons. So 2006, doing PHP, MySQL, and then I don't know 2007, 2008, found Python, and I went to a web conference, a tech conference called Future of Web Apps, and everyone was talking about Django, this thing that had been released. And I went home, typed in. It's like the web framework for perfectionists with a deadline. I'm like, that's me. And it wasn't just Django, it was Python as well. And it was like, ah, brilliant. So, and then yeah, writing web apps along with mobile apps and that kind of same time, exactly that same sort of timeline, same time zone. So about around the Django 1.0, 1.1 versions, that kind of thing.
So that was right. That was in the 1.0 days. And I can't remember what version it was like 1.3 or something, I think, when I started working on it.
Right, okay.
Anyway, yeah, that was how I got started.
Well, that's very early days. I mean, for me, I didn't really start programming till 2013, and then I was in San Francisco at startups, and it was like Rails or Django, and I think Django was the less popular choice, and I'm sort of a what's the word? Not iconoclast. What's the word, Carlton?
Johnny come lately, no?
No. Anyways, I was like, I'm not going to do the popular thing. And I like the look of Python, so I jumped on Django. But it
So what
wasn't
was the popular thing then? React, JavaScript, Node,
Rails. No, it was Rails.
Oh, that was way before React.
Yeah, I mean,
So I was
the company I was at was PHP. And everything was Rails. I mean, we were right next to Twitter, Square, Stripe. So yeah, it was all Rails. Boot camps had just started, and nobody was really doing Python or Django
Right, so
for
I'm
whatever.
remembering the React of the day was this thing called Boost. What was it?
Ember? No, was it
No,
Elm?
no,
What?
it was a thing written by Jeremy Ashkenaz. He was the guy who did
Oh,
Underscore.js,
yeah. Back,
Backbone.js.
Backbone, yay.
Yeah. So
Backbone.
that
Yeah,
was
we were
like kind of like
using.
an early form of like JavaScript SPA framework,
Well, it had all the great helper functions that kind of made their way into JavaScript itself.
And did I say his name correctly, Jeremy Ashkenaz? It's been so long since
I
I've
think
thought
so,
of this.
right? Because he's done a whole bunch of stuff too. He's done some other.
I'm sure he's gotten involved in a lot of other cool stuff. Seemed like a very prolific technologist.
Yeah, those people. So how did you so do you I mean, I guess it was a while back, but do you recall, I want to get to your JWT package. Like, did you start working on APIs with Django? Was it server side? Like, what was the progression, if you recall?
So I think that was the reason. Because, right, when I first started using Django, I was doing a lot of, what would you call it? Traditional sort of server-side rendered web apps. And of course, eventually the industry transitioned more towards just APIs interacting with, front-end clients essentially written in JavaScript. And so eventually I went to work for one of our clients when I worked at FusionBox, which is specialized bicycles, which is kind of a funny, place to find yourself as a software developer, some might guess. Because, I specialize obviously, and I'm talking about if you know bicycle brands, it's the Specialized you're thinking of in the United States. There's a kind of bike brand that's kind of on the same tier as Tech or Trek rather, and yeah, that's Specialized. So they had a number of kind of data collection services essentially that they needed to be written in-house, and that's what I was working on when I was there. And those were supporting all these kind of they were doing a lot of body metric collection with these little digital measurement devices they were making, and so I was writing the APIs that would receive data from those devices. And
so this was like pre-Strava. Was it GPS or was it like power? Do they have like power meters on the drivetrain?
Oh yeah. So there was things like that. And actually it was really around the same time as Strava, but our stuff was more just kind of like data collection. And so we had a few devices that we made to sort of give to people who were running specialized shops, and they could use it to like measure people's bodies, to like suggest products to them and things like that. So, anyway, yeah, so I was writing a lot of APIs, and we, like I said, this Specialized had been a client of Fusionbox, and so they had already been contracting with us to have some Django apps that we were writing, and so we had a few more kind of like traditional apps that were server side rendered, and then we were starting to do some kind of JavaScript front endy stuff with them. And so it was kind of a natural transition to just continue using Django. And so.
Was that Django REST framework or was that TastyPy? What was the time frame?
It was REST framework because it was.
So that's pretty early.
Yeah, right. So it was fairly early.
For REST framework.
Maybe Tom would correct us, but it seemed early, again, from my perspective.
Well, look, give you an idea. The REST framework version 3 Kickstarter was in 2014. So there must have been 2000. I was using REST framework around
it was already on
version
3.
1, version 2 in like 2011, 2012,
yeah, I was
something
doing
like
that.
That
too, yeah. And it was kind of competing with TastyPy. And I do remember that it seemed a little more newish and maybe sort of unproven. Again, Tom might correct us, but but it did seem like I got the impression that it just seemed a little more kind of clearly organized and things like that. And so we just made a call to use REST framework for the stuff we needed that kind of thing for. And then I just continued to use it, you know, at jobs after that. So we, as in Fusionbox guys, decided to use REST framework. So yeah, we were using that for our specialized work, and eventually we just needed a way to sort of do sort of single sign-on-y, like mobile client auth stuff. And JWTs were, again, from my point of view, seeming kind of like they were just showing up or starting to be used. And this would probably, this was like, I don't know, 2013 or 14, around that time, maybe a little later, 16 or 17.
So did you, yeah, I wanted to ask, so you created like the default right now, simple JWT, but Jose Padilla had a really popular package back then. I assume there was, I mean, his was still, you know, more maintained. So do you recall, you know, why create a new one?
Yeah, and I was trying to think about my reasons for this too. As far as I remember, so I was looking around for like what was available to use. And of course I ran across Jose's package. And I remember thinking that it seemed possible that it was maybe starting to be maintained less often. Or that was the general pulse I got on it when I was looking into it at the time. And so I started poking around under the hood with the package, and it seemed to me like there were really just a few classes he had written, which were really kind of driving the package. And I kind of thought, well, this stuff is, there's just a little bit here. And so I think I will just take what I need from this and start to just make something. It was almost like just sort of an academic exercise too. I was kind of like, how would I just sort of factor out the essential core of this and make my own version of it and do it in as few lines of code as possible? And so I started doing that, and it just kind of came together pretty quickly. And so I just decided to go with my own sort of version of it. And of course, eventually I got in touch with him and I sort of let him know that I had done this, and he was very encouraging because he was, I think at the time, already starting to feel like it was sort of, the package was going into disrepair a little bit, and that it was maybe useful for someone to come along and just sort of take up the reins or kind of reinvented or something like that. And so it seemed like the timing was good there, because yeah, I had a need for that kind of thing. I happened to notice that it seemed like maybe there could be another sort of a reworking of it. So yeah, that's how that happened. And yeah, so we just started
And now
using
you
it.
find yourself in the same position.
Yeah, so it was really funny, because like I did it just because I just had a habit of, I think I had developed a habit in my career of poking around under the hood of things and just seeing, is there just some like central core to how this works that I could just, some simple concept I could use. And so I just happened to do that with Jose's thing. And I also am just kind of a perfectionist somewhat. And so I just thought, well, if I were to make this something that people wanted to use, then I might as well just kind of like try to do it cleanly and sort of pretend like I'm making an open source package here that people might want to use. And
Yeah, was it your first? Was it your
That's a
first
dangerous thing.
open source package that you'd done for Django, anyways?
I mean, definitely the first one that took off. Like, I had done a few little sort of things that were on my GitHub. There was sort of like a smorgasbord of just sort of like half-baked things in my GitHub
Yeah.
account. But then I think the real critical like difference was that, yeah, it was just a time in my career where I just had enough experience to know how to put something together that's reasonably coherent. And I happen to have enough time and a reason to do it. And I
Yeah, but
also
not too
got
much experience to hesitate to do it.
right. Yeah, I didn't know what I was getting into. And I also reached out to Jose and also Tom Christie, because I had sort of borrowed components of their project to make this thing. And there were enough differences that it didn't feel like just a fork that I could just, or like a something I could make a PR for. And so I felt obligated to sort of notify them that I had done this, and or in particular Jose. And he was very receptive and positive about it. And then also I reached out to Tom and I said, okay, I think in like, I don't know, whatever chat channel is linked from the REST framework website. And I told him that I had done this thing, and I wondered if he wouldn't mind adding a link in the REST framework documentation to it. And that was, I think, when it really kind of took off, and the star count started just like exponentiating on GitHub, you know? So.
If you linked from the docs and then, people are looking for it and, I think it became clear after a while that Jose wasn't able to maintain DRF JWT, and then you came along with the perfect replacement, and it's like, yeah, that's super.
Yeah. And really my goal, actually, I think a particular goal I had when I was making it was, like I said, as few lines of code as possible, as transparently implemented as possible, so that if anybody came along and was like, oh, this doesn't do what I want, or this has some issue or whatever, then it shouldn't be hard for them to just like modify it to do what they want and create their own
Yeah.
fork. And that was a big goal for me, so I was striving for that.
But that makes it more maintainable as well, because you're able to say to people, hey, look, that's out of scope for what I want to do, but you could quite easily implement it like this, off you go. And
Yeah, right.
I'll link to the notes in DjangoCon 2018. I did a talk on auth with Django REST Framework, and actually where I met Carlton. And I remember asking Jose, I was like, hey, I'm doing this talk. Is your package still active? Should I've been using yours, but there's this simple JWT one. And he was like, oh, no, use the other one, use yours.
Oh
So
wow,
that was.
interesting. It's so funny. Man, there must be like a sort of constellation of activity in the community I'm just completely unaware of, because I don't really make the rounds at conferences very much.
Well, that was my first, my, I mean, my first one. This podcast came out about because going to one, I was like, oh, there's people talking about Django. Like, I never get that in my normal life, so I wanted to share it. But he was very, we had Jose on the podcast too. There's a past episode, but yeah, he was. Anyways, just he was very much like, oh yeah, like I c use David's. So I did. So
Cool.
it's in there.
Yeah. Well, actually, so another thing that happened, which I became aware of, is that It seems somebody did a screen, because I can see sort of like analytics for where activity comes from, or like where people, how people get to my GitHub page for the project. And there was a fair number of links that came from like a screencast somebody did, where they were like, this is how you do JWT with Django, like use this package.
Oh.
And
I wonder which one that was.
it was, yeah, I'm not sure if it was like a particularly well-known screencaster, but it definitely seemed like there was some clicks coming from there, so.
Well, I mean, YouTube has crazy numbers for online tutorials things, and I've learned in particular that anything Django REST framework for tutorials or for DjangoCon talks, there aren't many of them. So they get a lot of clicks. Like for example, that talk from 2018 is the has the most views of any talk from 2018. So I think partly I was like thinking like, well, I did a good job, but then I did a different talk in 2019 and I'm just like bottom of the barrel, and the top talk is another one on Django REST framework. So it's very much like, yeah, people just want to learn about that. Because I think also DjangoNauts, a lot of them don't know Django REST framework, or they don't like. I have a book on it, and I kind of thought that'd be my most popular book, actually, and it's by far my least popular book, because, and I think it's because professional Django developers basically only write backend APIs if you're at an agency or at a reasonably sized company. But I think when you're learning, or if you want to do a smaller project, generally you're just in the server side world, because it's too much to do Django plus, you know, whatever JavaScript framework of the week.
That's probably,
So I've found that interest. I've tried to communicate that, and I think I'm still not quite getting that across to people. They just don't, if they're learning on their own, they just don't understand why they would really use Django REST framework, or they don't have teammates to do it. So, anyways, side note. I initially was like Django for beginners, Django for APIs, and then this prose book, and it just turns out that APIs is actually like the last one people read, and it's really only in the context of once they get their first team job that they do it. Because I mean,
Interesting.
because writing an API is like, what's the point as for yourself, unless and then you got to go learn JavaScript, and
And it's
that's a lot for
probably
people.
like I think you were hinting at, it's probably a big ask to really sort of expect that somebody just getting into that stuff would be able to learn all the ins and outs and quirks of JavaScript and whatever you need to sort of get up and running with with that kind of stuff, and do that in addition to learning about Python and server-side development and all that kind of thing. So, yeah.
Right. Well, and specifically authentication, I found, you know, once I internalized what a serializer does, authentication is the part where, and I think this is still the case from people who contact me, that's the part where people go, "What?" Because, you know, you don't really have to understand sessions and session authentication with Django. It just kind of works. But then the official docs, I think, still list four. There's four built-in options, and then there's just like a dozen third-party packages. And I don't think it's that much clearer to people kind of what best to do. I mean, I think there is a sense of JWTs are a good idea, but then even there's multiple ways to do it. So that's the confusion point for people once they get past serializers, is like, I didn't know auth could be so hard. So maybe make the case for, so why use a JWT, or how do you think about that? Do you how do you think about that? Clearly you're with the package, so you use them. But if someone came to you, and are there cases where you wouldn't recommend using it?
So I remember when I was first considering using them, I think I basically had two needs for them. Like I said, we were talking about doing single sign-on. And so I think I was finding information about JWTs because there's this idea that you could just have the same verifying key across different services. And so you only really need to sign on with the service that has the sign-in key. And so they can sort of function as a single sign-on system in that way. But the other need I had was that we were going to write an API for a mobile client, And I think we were working with some contractors from a different agency to do this. And those guys were just comfortable using JWTs because I think they had gained enough of a footing in that sort of area of tech that they were already being used for that kind of thing. So, yeah, so I think those were a couple of the reasons I started to use them. I mean, as far as like, I still think it's interesting how you can just sort of avoid database hits. To authenticate requests. And that's kind of like one of the attractive things about JWTs, you know, because like you don't have to go query the database to find a session record. Like you can just verify the signature and that's all you need. And that's a relatively inexpensive operation compared with a trip to and from the database. So if you're really trying to go after performance in a service, then I feel that that could be a consideration. And I feel like I've tried to sort of emphasize that with that package. I mean, I feel like there are other ways that that tends to get broken. Like if you want to implement blacklists, you know, token blacklists and things like that, then you just kind of have to do a database query anyway. And so you've kind of thrown that out the window. Or I don't know. I mean, maybe there are ways you could optimize that, but
Yeah,
yeah.
no, but yeah, if it performance were an issue, you'd put a caching layer in and blah 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 and all those
Yeah,
kind of.
right. Yeah. You can cache things and be smart about it. But you still have to sort of open up a socket to your caching server and
Yeah,
you know, you
sure.
can't just do it completely within the confines of the Gunicorn process or something, you know, like you have to do some IO in order to serve that request. But I guess you're doing that already anyway. You're doing IO with the web server. Anyway, you know what I'm saying. Like
Yeah.
there are some considerations along those lines. And so I've tried to sort of remind people of that because a lot of people come in the issues of the JWT package and they're like, well, why don't you just do blacklist by default or this or that? And kind of like, well, you
Yeah.
know, like ideally you wouldn't have to do that kind of thing if you don't want to. And yeah, so that's one of the things I kind of harp on in the issues section. As far as reasons not to use it, I mean, I think in general, when you're trying to make any decision about some technology to use, it's just good to understand a little bit about how it works internally. And so in this case, you know, understand a bit about digital signing and why you can authenticate a request without hitting a database just by checking the validity of a signature. And so when you understand a few of those basic bullet points about something you're trying to use, then you know exactly why you would use it, you know. And if your, you know, use case doesn't match those criteria, then just don't use it. You know, just use OAuth or use just database sessions or, you know. In other words, don't use it just because it's cool and new and shiny, right? So, yeah.
I think that the reason most people got into it, particularly at that time, and I'm sure there are other token-based systems available now, but back in the, few years ago in the mobile boom, it was like, oh, I need a token-based system that's, because it's much easier than trying to get a cookie, which I could then
Yeah,
send along,
right.
to try and do session auth with a mobile, from iOS. Yeah, you can do it, but you're jumping through hoops. Whereas if you can just get a token and attach it to the request, bam, I'm in the business, multiple mobile clients, multiple platforms. This is exactly what we need. Brilliant.
Yeah,
I think
right.
that's where most people
That's how
arrived at
people think of
JWT.
it. That's how people think of it. Although to be a little bit of a stickler, in a funny way, a cookie is a token, you know, like
Yeah, well,
is
I
a
guess,
random
yeah.
number which you use to
Yeah.
look up a session. So, so yeah, I don't know. It's, but I don't want to be a jerk and like try and
No,
question for
no,
certain
you should be. I mean,
questions.
we're all opinions matter. I was going to say, so a reader was recently trying to correct me, saying in my book, I say, well, if you have a token, you could store it traditionally in local storage or in cookies. And he was making the point of, I think he saw, oh, what's his name's? Who had that? There's a long piece on why local storage is evil by, oh, I'm blanking on it. Anyways, I'm curious on thoughts around security for where one should store a cookie or a token, because that often
Yeah.
comes up in the context of like, don't use local storage or don't use a cookie, it's insecure. And I see there was a Reddit thread on this just very recently, and there's a lot of misinformation out there. So I'm curious, what both of you think about what advice you would give around storing it. Carlton, you're a former maintainer, you're a Django fellow, you know. I'm just a writer, so.
Yeah.
I'm probably I just keep the issue covered.
I could know more.
I mean, you're familiar with this. You're familiar with this
well, I could
it's
say
a debate,
one or
I think
things.
Really. I mean,
yeah, no, for sure.
Yeah, what would you
and
say?
Actually,
Dave?
There's been this sort of open PR. It's just I feel ashamed to even mention it. There's been a PR open forever, and I have not merged it in. It's just been one of these things where it's like just big enough that it's just too much work for me to look at it, and I never have enough time to do it.
yeah.
And it's this PR to do HTTP only cookies,
yeah.
And to have that be where the JWT is stored. Yeah. And I mean, I think I understand the reasoning behind that because, you know, that's out of the reach of JavaScript. So if your site has been XSS'd somehow, then you're okay as far as that goes. Or at least that's my understanding of it. So I mean, I guess that's the trade-off for me. Like local storage, you know, JavaScript has access to it, and if someone somehow manages to inject JavaScript into your site, then you're hosed. But if you're using HTTP only cookies, then you're not. So that's kind of the main difference as far as I can see it. I should probably read this piece that you're talking about.
I'm just trying to, I was just looking at it yesterday. I'll add it. Because there's literally like, I mean, I almost feel like we should, there's this whole Reddit thread, just on this very issue and lots of, misconception. What is his name? Oh, Randall Deeks.
Yeah, actually, I think I should comment that, the reason that was not included by default in my package is because, as I mentioned, we were using this framework with mobile clients. Mm-hmm. And so there's really no concept of a distinction between different kinds of storage on a mobile client. You know, it's just on the client, right? And so you just send it along with the request and a header, and it's up to the client to figure out where they want to store it. And so that was kind of the attitude that I think led to that not being available. But that's the main thing that I just need to like sit down and grow up and just merge that PR and get it taken care of.
But it's not as, well, there's two things to say. One is, it's from the maintainer's point of view, it's not as simple as just, oh, I need to merge that. It becomes this rock that you have to carry around with you all the time.
Exactly.
And And it's not that you don't care or that you aren't committed or that I just literally haven't got the mental space to deal with this quite difficult topic properly. And it just, you know, the maintenance of an open source package becomes really difficult over time for that exact reason.
And it's so funny. Like my perspective on that whole thing obviously has changed considerably since this package became popular. Because I used to be, I think, like a lot of typical open source users where they just kind of show up and, you know, if the package doesn't do what you want, it's frustrating. You've got work you have to get done. And you just feel like, you know, why does the package do this? It should do this, you know?
You feel entitled. Long essays on the issue tracker about why your package should be better, but no PR to make it better.
Right.
The time that could have been spent to fix it is spent complaining. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, I was that person, and I think back on it, and I feel sad. And now I obviously the tables have turned, and I'm like, okay, now I get it. It's hard. Like you're saying, you just don't have the mental space, and you might have a certain standard that you're trying to maintain.
Yeah, exactly.
Quality, and you feel obligated to sort of essentially rewrite people's PRs in a lot of ways. And
But you've got X number of users. You can't merge something that you're not confident of and put a new package out
you
and release that.
You have a responsibility to the people using it.
The damage to a broken fix is more than the benefit of getting the merge in. So that's kind of a as your package gets more popular, it becomes increasingly conservative necessarily.
Yeah, right. And actually, I've seen a lot of people who sort of take this approach to the life cycle of any project where you have like a decreasing version number, And when the version number gets to one or zero or some, magic
Just stop
number,
merging
you
stuff.
can't make any more additions to it. And so you sort of like, you better be working towards the definitive, like, watertight version of the package, or you're going to be in for trouble, Yeah.
I really
Tom's
like
working
that.
towards Django REST framework adopting something similar to that. I think he's, but yeah, no, it makes a lot of
Well,
sense. I was gonna
I think the thing
go
with
ahead,
REST
Carl.
framework is that there's like it's on 3. 12 to be soon. 3.11 now, 3.12 will be soon, just as soon as we get the the pandemic lets us get the PRs finished
Right.
and get it out the door.
Right.
But there is no dying need for Django REST framework version 4. So it's going to be 3. So then at what point? Well, okay, can we refresh the version numbering to say give a more time-based idea, or perhaps to say keeping up with Django and say, okay, we make version 4 match Django version 4 and say, if you're going to be on Django version 4, use REST framework version 4. Maybe these are some ideas, but the idea being that Django REST framework is kind of it's kind of done now. It just
Yeah,
needs to
right.
keep ticking
And
over.
I think it's weird, because that's actually an extremely healthy attitude to have towards a software project. Although it's sort of not fashionable, because you always want to give the impression that your project is like hot and there's like lots of activity going on. But I think it's better to strive towards some core, like, useful thing, which is like coherent and useful enough that it can just sort of stand on its own, like, for the ages, and yeah, that's like, I think that's a better approach to take.
No, but Django's exactly like this, right? Django is super stable, 15 years old, super stable, it's
Right.
keep growing new features all the time, but it's that reliable rock of the ages thing. And then REST frameworks around it, and there's Django Filter and Crispy Forms, and I don't know whatever packages that have been around for forever. And
Yeah.
they're
And I
not going
think
anywhere.
part of what allows them to do that is, like I was saying, there's some set of core concepts that really upholds the project or the package, and they've just been dialed in really precisely and they work really well. And it's kind of a testament to something that was really well thought out, And it's like just I mean, Django is a complex framework, but one of the things I try to go for when I write software is just to simplify as much as possible. Like, there's just a few lines of code essentially that's doing what is important, and you just really need to zero in on that.
I think that holds true of Django as well. Like, you've got the core HTTP handlers. It's only
Right.
160 lines in the file. It's not
Yeah, that's true.
complicated.
Yeah, and like the core, like, form classes and things like
There's only a
that.
couple of
Yeah,
classes.
that's right. Yep.
I think you have to be at an expert level to see that, but it is the case. I mean, that's like, I always think if something seems incredibly complicated to you, you don't really, I mean, that's what Einstein's thing, right? Like, you don't fully understand it. Because if you can just go, well, there's this and this and then blah, 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 blah. I mean, you can boil most things down to that, but it's n not always easy to do that. Like, when I, like, to total beginner with Django, I often try to say, like, well, you need, a model URL view and a template. And once you kind of internalize that for a single page, like, you're good. I can say that until I turn blue in the face, but then when you get on the other side, you're like, yeah. Or then you can say, like Carlton's talk he gave last year, where, like, what is Django? It's basically middleware, and it's just like a onion in a way, a little bit of ORM,
Little
but that's
bit.
easy to say, and that doesn't mean anything to anyways. What I think is interesting too,
Little
just
bit of
authentication and
ORM. Yeah, I like that.
authentication in general is challenging and changes because the web changes. I mean, this is for Django itself, if we had I so I so I'm on the board and trying to raise money, and if we had a whole slug of money, the auth package is something that we would put it towards if we were going to do updates. Like, authentication in particular is something that needs work, and I think maybe even more than other things, changes on the web as best practices change. Would you agree with that, Carlton?
Yeah, I think that's on the list. I mean, they're discussing JWT on the mailing list just this week, and
Yeah.
there's comments about it being an overly complicated protocol, and so
Yeah.
security issues have come up because of that. And
Yep.
so, if we're not going to have, there was a talk about bringing JWT or at least some of the foundations of it into Django, as so that packages could build on it. And it was like, well, no, not JWT because it's overly complex, and then there are better algorithms, but we haven't, or better protocol, better specs, better specs to follow that are simpler and do the same thing, give you all the benefits but without the downsides. So what would they be? What might we do? You know, this is an ongoing discussion.
Yeah. It seems like you could just take a subset of the JWT spec and just sort of enshrine that as the approved, like, configuration of JWT or something.
Yeah, I mean, somebody mentioned platform agnostic security tokens on the list as, you know, and it's supposed to be everything you love about, you know, JWT or whatever, but without the design baggage. I don't know.
Coming a little bit up on time, but I did want to ask you about what you've been doing these days, where I think you're currently at a company called Unsupervised, and you're more dipping into the AI world. Is that accurate?
Yes. Yeah, that's right. And of course, I just came from, I've kind of been through an interesting...
Oh, Ethereum, yeah.
Yeah, I've been through an interesting tour of different areas of the technology world in the past couple of years. Because I feel like I can't just skip over the Ethereum Foundation stuff. I'll just touch on that briefly if that's okay before answering. Because I had a friend who I probably shouldn't name names too much because people in the crypto world are kind of sensitive about having really public personas because they tend to be very big targets security wise. So I had a friend who I worked with earlier in my career, who was kind of involved with that organization from pretty early on. And so that was my connection there. And I hadn't previously really been into crypto stuff. Like, there's a certain sort of category of technology people who are super passionate about that and super into it. And I wasn't really one of those people, but I sort of came away, and in a way I'm glad, because I came in very sort of innocent, like with no preconceived like ideas about what I was getting into, and even actually a fair bit of skepticism, because I recognize there's this just sort of inherent hype factor around cryptocurrency stuff that just to me is just sort of a critical thinker, just kind of turned me off, frankly, of it.
Me too.
But I came away just being with a different kind of attitude, like, oh, well, there's kind of a very interesting trend in distributed systems happening. That was my takeaway, like some people figured out kind of this clever way to have a shared, verified, cryptographically verified database. And other people are also working on kind of, next generation, like peer-to-peer, like file sharing networks. And there's just a lot of interesting kinds of projects in that space. And so that was definitely eye-opening and a very useful experience for me. So yeah, without spending too much time on that, I just wanted to touch on it. So yeah, but the thing I should say is that even before Ethereum, the area of tech I was starting to just personally be very interested in was the machine learning, deep learning scene. And I had taken Andrew Ng's, I think, that's how you pronounce his name, Ng.
Yeah, I'm not sure either.
I've been told different things, yeah. Andrew Ng's machine learning course on Coursera. I think I took...
So not... you completed it?
You
actually completed it?
Yeah.
Because I know, I think it's like 100,000 people signed up and like maybe a couple hundred completed it or something.
I definitely
it's all
completed
math-y.
It. And it, I think it connected with sort of... how could I say it? Like one of the things I think that inspired me to get really into programming originally, or one of the things I found myself pondering like really early on when I was learning to write code, is just, I think any person who learns to write software has this sort of initial learning curve of how do I translate my thoughts into discrete steps that a computer could understand? And that's just like a naturally hard thing for humans to do. Like any person, I mean, it seems from my point of view, any person who's not accustomed to writing software has this initial phase where they just have to learn how to think clearly and discreetly. Like, because when you ask yourself, how do I like divide a number? Like, well, you just do it. Like, it's just kind of a single motion of like handwriting on the paper and But when you actually think about how you have to do it with some like primitive set of operations, it's difficult. And so, you know, there's and also there are certain classes of things which are like processes which are very natural to represent mechanically. And there are other things that which are not, like, you know, mathematics, number crunching, calculation, or I should say calculation, not mathematics. Calculation is very natural to represent with a computer. But, you know, recognizing an object in the environment like humans do naturally, in a funny sort of ironic way, some of the things we do most naturally are the hardest to represent, like mechanistically, right? Like, how do we recognize objects in the environment? How do we even like recognize textures, colors, like these things? It's kind of interesting when you you look at the spectrum of phenomena, and like there's like this gray area where things start to be very difficult for a computer to deal with, right? And so I think really early on, that was just an interesting thing to me, like just observing how I learned how to write software and how, like, say if I wanted to write a video game character and I wanted it to behave naturally and not like sort of awkwardly and robotically, like how would I even do that? Like I was asking those questions really early on. And so I also had the good fortune of sharing an office at one of my earlier jobs with a guy who had done a proper PhD in AI way back in the 90s and 80s. This is like a totally different era of AI, you know. And
Yeah.
so I think my relationship with him also helped me really get curious about that topic. And I remember he showed me how to implement a backprop neural network, because this is a concept which has been around since like the 80s or probably even earlier. Like the whole basic idea of a perceptron, and like there's some of this really early work has been in the literature since decades ago and just didn't really come into popularity until recently, for all kinds of different reasons. And so I got some early exposure to that. And so, you know, fast forward. So by this person I shared an office with was in the late 90s, around the turn of the millennium. And fast forward 10, 15 years, suddenly, you know, we have a few sort of algorithmic advancements, hardware advancements, like people start using GPUs to do compute. And so all these critical elements come together, and there's this kind of renaissance revolution in deep learning. And, you know, it was just one of the things that I noticed happening in the technology world. I noticed this starting to happen, and I was thinking, oh yeah, this is, I used to be really interested in this. And all these learning resources start popping up, like Andrew Ng's course and things like that. And so I just personally got back into it. I just have found it naturally fascinating, like from a technology point of view, from a philosophical point of view, like there's just so much about it which is there for me. So yeah.
And so what is on so you're working on this product or this startup unsupervised?
Yeah. So I think there's only a certain amount I can really say, but
Well, the tagline is autonomous analysis.
exactly. That's it. So I guess
There you are.
that's the headline on our page.
It's on the website, so I
I
assume you can
suppose I
say
wasn't
that.
even aware of that. So that's it. There's like a certain sort of collection of things that data scientists tend to do to help companies understand data. And we're basically trying to automate that. And we're trying to use AI in order to explore the space of possible ways of looking at data automatically. And also intelligently, like not just like doing a grid search through, that's like a kind of technical term, like grid search through the parameters of how you might configure a data processing pipeline, but trying to sort of leverage some actual developments in AI algorithms to effectively search through that space of possible ways of looking at data. And so the idea is that we should be able to give a company access to our data analysis system, and they can just sort of send their data in, and the system comes back and says, hey, you should look at this group of customers. There's a lot of interesting activity happening in this area. Or you should, like, what do you think about this way of looking at things? Is this interesting? Is this not interesting? And you can sort of like give some feedback and have that modify the behavior of the system. And so, yeah.
And does that interact with Django? Or, I mean, there's a web component. That's a, like, a, as a broad, naive question, I'm always curious how web interacts with machine learning, because you need to store it and interact with people in some way, even though it's not the main focus.
Yeah. And I mean, we do have web apps, which are kind of like the interface to the system, obviously. But it's not necessarily Django. Like, it's just kind of, you know, because I came into the company after a lot of those choices had already been made about what technologies to use. I mean, it is Python.
Mm-hmm.
But not exactly Django. And
is
so,
it not exactly Flask either? It's
oh, it
just
is
sort
Flask.
Of homegrown.
I can say it's Flask.
I mean, there's two options basically. And when you say Flask, that just encompasses everything else. You know, it's.
Yeah. So we use Flask a fair bit.
Yeah. I was going to, there's this book, AI Superpowers, that came out in 2018 that I read, which for a layman like myself was a really good introduction to machine learning and the capabilities. And the author, who I think who got a PhD in Carnegie Mellon back in the like the 80s, and then he ran Google in China and all the Apple and Microsoft. And he was making the point, kind of what you said, that basically we finally have these deep learning algorithms that that we were waiting on. He said there's three things you need. You need computing power, you need the algorithms, and you need the data set. And so his argument is we have the computing power, we have the algorithms, they're all, you know, academic, you know, they're out there. And so it's a question of data. And he's, I think he's from China. He grew up in the US, but he's back. I mean, he has a Chinese point of view. So he's very much like China is just going to crush the world. And he gives the example of when with the Go, deep was a DeepMind, the Go game in, was it 2013, beat AlphaGo. Yeah, that he says that was a Sputnik moment in China.
Yeah, right. I've heard that analogy
because,
used.
Yeah, that, mm-hmm. And he said, they kind of realized, oh wow, this is a big thing, and he gives examples of how China is sort of throwing cash, you know, in sort of a government kind of way, setting up these innovation centers and this and that, and you know that combined with they kind of skipped the landline internet and went to phones. He's very bullish on the Chinese approach and kind of glosses over the surveillance stuff.
Yeah,
but
also,
anyways,
actually,
that was a good
sorry.
Book.
Sorry to interrupt. Go on.
Yeah, no, that's all I was gonna say.
Yeah, I just wanted to comment because you said, you know, you need the algorithms, you need the compute, you need the data.
That's what he says. Yes.
That's interesting to say because that touches on one of the things that I think we're trying to do at Unsupervised, which is, you know, indicated in the name of the company. So we're really focusing on this class of algorithms called unsupervised learning algorithms. And the reason we're doing that is because in a way, we don't have the data. People who have the data are Google and Amazon, but Google and Amazon are two, you know, very specific organizations which have the data. Most people don't have the data, so to speak, because they don't have the massive data sets necessary to really train these algorithms correctly, or supervised learning algorithms. And so there's this whole other class of algorithms where there's not a need to have a very large, very well curated data set, or there's less of a need. And so we're sort of targeting that area because we think there's a lot of promise. And I think that would, the world of unsupervised learning algorithms is the area which has to be developed in order for AI to really become like the sort of future world technology that we think of it, you know, like ubiquitous, like used for everything. There needs to be a way that we can find to leverage all the data, whether or not it's labeled. That's kind of the key takeaway.
Like, well, because I think the, again, just going off of the book, he was mentioning that many of the deep learning algorithms, you need narrow, discrete kind of data, like, you know, is it a car? Is it not a car? So yeah. The quality of the data set is paramount, as opposed to what, you know, maybe what you're saying with, you know, most of the world isn't organized like that, the data. So
yeah. And actually that's probably how I should have said it. Like, you know, obviously we all have access to a lot of data these days. Like we can do a Google search, we can just go crawl the web for just random information, but only a few organizations have access to really well curated data. And that's people like Google.
Well, and I don't know if that's the same type of machine learning, where there's the idea that it would, like with Go, you kind of know where you want to, you feed data to the algorithm that says, like, this is what a car is. And then the computer figures out its own metrics for determining what a car is. So it works backwards in a way from the solution, right? I believe that's kind of the central idea of why you need that structured data, because the computer will find its own way, you know, or a deterministic game like chess or Go, it will figure out how it wants to get there, but it needs to kind of know where it needs to go. That's why it needs to be structured. Is that accurate?
Yeah.
that's how I've been thinking about it, but.
Yeah, well, so I guess I can say it's, I'm wondering how intelligently I can comment on this.
More than I can, I'm sure.
So when you're training a supervised algorithm, you're essentially training a statistical model.
Yeah.
You know, and so if the statistical variations in the data set don't include information about the correct way to look at the data set, then in a way there's nothing to train on. That's kind of one way to say it. Like, like if you don't have this sort of, like if you have a bunch of samples.
You need a notion of fit.
Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly. You're trying to fit something. You're trying to fit a curve, or you're trying to fit a certain style of like categorizing things. And if you don't have that information, then you can't cue off that. But there are different ways to kind of look at it. Like you can, I think I'm not really a super expert in this area, but this is like stuff I'd like to learn more about. I think one of the approaches is to look for the sort of latent statistical information in a data set, and then try and find trends in that sort of latent statistics, in those latent statistics.
It's kind of what a human analyst does, right? They get some data, they put it into different graphing structures and see which ones, look at clusters like this or clusters like that. And the human eye is very good at picking that out. And that's sort of one of the early descriptive statistics that you do early on before you get down to the proper number crunching. It's just looking at it. It's just, look, here's the shape of the distribution. And we can already learn some things. But humans are good at that. But I don't know that machines yet are.
Well, so here's the one sort of, here's a particular sort of topic which I found interesting. And like I was saying, when you train a deep learning model, you have to have this target that you're trying to get to. Like, you have to have this set of correct classifications of things you're trying to classify. Like, if you have a bunch of images, you need to know, is this a dog, is this a cat, so on and so forth. A different approach is to train a deep learning model to simply output whatever it's given. But what you're doing in the process is you're forcing this data to flow through a representation that's less, has less fidelity than the original input. And so what the model is then forced to do is find the essential patterns in the data that you're giving to it. It has to find a way. So when you're training this model, it goes through this sort of narrow, sort of low fidelity representation. But then the goal is to reconstruct the original input. And so what the model is then forced to do is to find the most important sort of latent patterns in the data set. And that's like sort of a shortcut in a way. Like, you're finding this sort of patterns which are just inherently there in that kind of data. And then you're saying, okay, well, those patterns are clearly what's important. So we don't have to waste a lot of time sort of training those up from just raw classifications. Like, that stuff is going to be there or not, whether or not we have classifications. And so that's one sort of, I think, direction people are going in to try and find a way to leverage unlabeled data. And that's kind of tied in with this area of research with things called autoencoders, variational autoencoders, and so that's a really interesting particular topic in that area to me, which I want to learn more about. But that's just an example of unsupervised versus supervised models, you know.
As we kind of wrap up, how would you recommend, say someone who knows a little bit about Python and Django but is curious about ML, what would be a where should they start? I mean, because Andrew Ng's course is sort of famously fine, 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 and then like, oh my God, math. Is there a way that you would that was my experience with it. What would you suggest to like a listener of the podcast or a, co-host who's interested in this area? Because I think this stuff is like the coolest stuff, right? I mean, web stuff is a little bit, it is what it is, but sort of a solved problem. But this is all uncharted frontier.
I mean, I would say the course is definitely a good place to start. I mean, you definitely get to that math point. But I think you can just tell yourself, well, as much as I can get away with ignoring the math for now, I should try to do that and just try and go work through the exercises and see how far I can get. And you probably have to struggle through things a little bit in that sense up front. But I think what's cool about those courses is that if you can get things working, it's just really satisfying and it's really interesting to see it work. I took actually, there was another course I took, which was also by Andrew Ng. It was a series of courses all about deep learning. And there was a little bit later on in the series, they get into this neural style transfer algorithm where you have two input images to the algorithm. One is an image which contains some artistic style, essentially, and the other is an image which contains some content that you want the style applied to. And so, of course, the output is the content image in the style of the style image. So you can take like a picture of yourself and make it look like Van Gogh painted it or something like that. And the algorithm works remarkably well. And to see it work is just amazing, in my opinion. To imagine that we're at a point now where a computer algorithm could so effectively sort of deal with artistic styles in this way that it's doing is just mind-boggling to me. And so I guess my point is just if you can somehow get hands-on with the algorithms and see them work, it's just really interesting and inspiring. And I would hope that that would kind of eventually lead a person to try and learn more about the mathematics because I personally believe there's a lot there to that you could get as well. But
Well, I'm sure you've heard like with these algorithms will write a piece like Bach or Beethoven or Haydn, and it's crazy how they how kind of like they it sounds like they pick up the underlying algorithms of those composers, and it's a new piece, and maybe it's not quite as good, but it's like it does sound like them.
Well, I mean, so again, it's like I just want to urge people not to give up on the math because, especially in the case of the neural style transfer algorithm, if you understand a thing or two about the math, in my opinion, it can tell you a little bit about the artistic process in humans and why people do art at all. I mean, I know people who are in the AI space are always kind of like a little bit cautious about making pronouncements like that, drawing too many direct comparisons between the ways that deep learning algorithms work and the way that biological brains work. Because obviously there's well, not obviously, but it is supposedly the case that there's a fair bit of complexity in a biological brain, which is just not represented in a algorithmic brain, I guess you would say. But when I was learning about that algorithm, it taught me something, I believe, that I just never realized about art. And why do humans at all care about abstract forms, shapes? Why do we care about representing things from the real world in this abstract form that we call art? Why is that important to us? And it seems like it could actually serve an important function in just the way that the brain works. When you look at deep learning algorithms, there's all these neurons kind of packed in the middle of the algorithm, which are doing things that we kind of don't really know what they're doing. We don't have much insight into it. And it seems to me like it's possible that artwork could kind of serve to give access to those kind of hidden layers somehow. So yeah. And again, that's like, I feel like that came to me just from understanding a bit about the math of how those things work. So I encourage people to look into
Fair enough. That's cool.
I can't think of a better way to
that.
end. You are looking for help with the simple JWT package. Is that correct?
I've recruited a couple people recently who are trying to do some triage just on issues to just hopefully help people out with some of the more simple things that come into the issues section. I've been just extremely busy just with work lately, so I haven't had a lot of time to actually look at PRs and merge them. But I'm kind of aware that that's an issue. So yeah, potentially looking for more people to help with that, especially people that have like lots of just real experience and association with other like prominent projects in the space. And I also was looking into maybe getting it added to this organization called Jazz Band for a while.
Well, yeah, because Django Restoth was just merged over, which is a very popular way to do. It kind of gives you pre-built auth stuff. That seems to be successful that they merged that over in the last year or two to Jazz Band.
I still am strongly considering that. I was kind of back and forth on it because I thought maybe it'd still be nice to sort of have a sense of ownership over the project, but it may not be realistic for me to try to do that. But I was actually having a little bit of trouble like contacting them, so I should try again and see if I can get through.
Well, it's a foundational piece of the modern Django web stack. So hopefully someone listening can help us make those connections because we need that package
Well, and so
to
the good
work.
news I'll just remind people is that it's a pretty simple package. Like there's just not many lines of code there. So if it has fallen a little bit into sort of like, if I haven't had a lot of time to look at it recently, I don't think it would be very hard to sort of get it back into shape. So yeah,
And
that's.
I'll say my bit here, which I always say is that contributing to an open source project is a great learning opportunity, and it's a really good way of boosting your profile, and it's a really good way of giving back to the communities. And if you've been thinking about it, and you use simple JWT, then maybe the planets align.
Yeah, please come and make your contribution and please be patient as people find time to look at it and whatnot. So
Yeah, we
yeah.
should say that to all the people with the issues. Like, be patient. Like, you got to realize that it's not some organization with lots of people and lots of hands. It's one person. Oh, I'll just look at one more ticket. Like,
Well, I guess as one last point, I wanted to say you were saying earlier about being one of those people who, or people who get worked up about something that isn't solved versus solving it themselves. I mean, I'm that way too, but a lot of times that's the type of person, if someone's passionate enough about something, even if it's in a negative sense, that can be turned into something good. In the same way that, like, for companies I've worked at, if someone takes the time to write in or someone takes the time to tell me my books are terrible, I can usually engage and flip that person. It's people who aren't passionate, who don't care, that have no engagement with the
Yeah,
project
that's
or the
true.
community. So I think it's good to harness that passion. And I always look at it as whether it's an open source thing or one of my books, if someone takes the time to do that and they have that passion, they're basically saying, convince me, convince me. And they can be convinced. It's the person who doesn't even bother writing or complaining that isn't going to
Yeah,
engage.
that's true. It's a opportunity to communicate.
Well, we have links to everything in the show notes. Thank you so much for taking the time to come on and
Yeah, thanks a lot, guys. This
share
was
your
really
journey.
fun.
It's been really interesting. All right. Well, everyone, we're at ChatChango on Twitter, and we'll see you all next week.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.